All right, now we want to talk about John Henry Cardinal Newman, who was born in 1801 and died in 1890. Kierkegaard reacted against the shift in the secular direction that occurred in the middle of the 18th century and in his own time. Kierkegaard's attitude was, in effect, that you couldn't answer non-Christian argumentation on its own ground, because that argumentation was necessarily against personal Christian experience. We've seen that this was a throwing out of the baby with the bathwater, that the non-Christian positions that Kierkegaard deals with can certainly be answered and need to be answered on an objective basis. It's not enough just to affirm our subjective commitment to Christ, because that any other religionist can do in terms of his own inner position. It becomes essential to offer a reason for the hope that is within us, and that reason can be presented without falling into the presumption that Hegel represented. John Henry Cardinal Newman is more sophisticated than Kierkegaard in realizing that you can deal with unbelief in terms of objective evidence. You don't have to run from objective evidence because of the difficulties that the presentation of it offers. John Henry Newman refines the objective apologetic that we have found to be present in the classical Christian era. You can easily get material on Newman because he was one of the great thinkers of the 19th century. You can read the biographical article on him in the Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition, also to be sure in the Catholic Encyclopedia, either the First Catholic Encyclopedia of 1911 or the New Catholic Encyclopedia. And there are numerous references there. There is a marvelous work in French, which unfortunately has not been translated into English, entitled La Philosophie de Newman, The Philosophy of Newman, written by the great French lay Catholic theologian and philosopher Jean Guiton, G-U-I-T-T-O-N. Guiton is one of my favorite writers. Some of his stuff has been translated into English, but this early work, it was done in 1933, has not been translated. There's a reference to Guiton in the preface to my book, Where is History Going? There I cite Guiton's description of a conversation he had with a non-Christian physician. The non-Christian physician said, I can accept everything in the Apostles' Creed except he suffered under Pontius Pilate. And Guiton says, but that's the most basic heresy of all. And if you think about it, it is. You see, the physician was saying, I can take everything in the Apostles' Creed as myth, but I won't take it as actual history, is embedded in historical reality under Pontius Pilate. And Guiton was perceptive enough to realize that that turns Christianity into Gnosticism, eliminates a historical faith. So Guiton did this fine work on Newman, and if you're able to read French, you'd be interested in it, but if you don't, you'll find a great deal of stuff in English on Newman, and it's most interesting. Newman is known not only as an apologist, but also as an important figure in the history of 19th century, of the 19th century church, a figure in church history in general, and also as a great educationalist. Newman moved from Anglicanism to Roman Catholicism. He was one of the leaders in the high church movement in England in the 19th century. The movement that is usually designated as the Tractarian movement, the Tractarian movement. Others in that movement were Kebler, or Kebler is a good example of one of the people in the movement. They engaged in a very, very warm and excellent devotional life. The movement was influenced a bit by 19th century Romanticism. They became a bit too romantic about the Middle Ages, but it bore a great deal of fruit, particularly in devotional literature, hymn writing, prayers, that sort of thing. A great liturgical revival occurred as a result of that activity. Now, Newman went, in my opinion, too far. He finally found himself in the arms of Rome, and Newman himself may have felt that way about it too, because after he became Roman Catholic, hardly had he become Roman Catholic, but the First Vatican Council took place in 1870, and the Pope was declared infallible. Up to 1870, you could have regarded the Pope as a permanent booby and not been in any difficulty doctrinally. The Pope could have been mistaken daily, hourly, always, constantly, and it wouldn't have been any difficulty for your eternal welfare. But after 1870, when the Pope spoke or speaks ex cathedra from the chair on matters of faith and morals, you jolly well better accept it, or you're in big trouble if you're a Roman Catholic. Newman had not held to the infallibility of the Pope, but between 1870 and his death in 1890, he sure as anything held to the infallibility of the Pope. Newman's life is written in his autobiography. It is magnificent, well worth reading. It's entitled, it has a Latin title, Apologia pro vita sua, defense of his own life, using the Latin from the Greek apology. And this indicates that he did apologetics not only for historic Christianity, but also for Newman, because he had a lot to explain, having moved out of the Tractarian movement and into Catholicism. As an educationalist, he wrote the great work, Idea of a University, which, in my opinion, remains as the greatest single defense of a Christian university idea. It's the greatest single defense of the notion of a Christian university. It is a masterpiece. When I went to Cornell as an undergraduate, I was in a tutorial reading program, and this reading program had its reading list set up by secularists at the university, people like Max Black in philosophy, good old Max, Black Max, as we called him when he wasn't around. One of the first things that we were assigned to read in this tutorial program was Newman's Idea of a University. We had to read the whole thing through. And the reason was that the people who created that program felt that they had to disabuse us of that idea. They had to smash the idea of an integrated Christian framework of knowledge, because only then could we appreciate what the modern university was attempting to do. And those who got disabused found that the modern university wasn't a university at all. It wasn't a universitas. There wasn't any universality. It was nothing but a cafeteria line in which there was no inherent relationship of anything involved, none whatever. Where you can finally get degrees for the trampoline and driver's education on exactly the same ground as you can for Sanskrit or theology. Yes. But we're concerned with Newman as an apologist for historic Christianity. What did Newman attempt to do? He attempted to refine the concept of probability relative to apologetics. He focused on applying probability evidence to the history of salvation in a more careful way than had been done before. Now, we've already seen probability poking its attractive face up in the history of apologetics. We've seen Gregory of Valencia doing a bit with probability. We've seen this appearing later in Pascal in a little bit different way. But it's Newman who analyzes the concept of probability with more care than anyone else until the analytical philosophers work on it from a philosophical standpoint in our own century. It's plain that Newman was very much bothered by Lessing's ditch. He wasn't bothered because he thought Lessing's ditch was very deep, or that there was any good reason for falling into it. But he saw nincompoops tripping and breaking their necks in this ditch that was only about 6 inches deep. And it disturbed him that people would get into that trouble over what really wasn't a chasm at all, but nothing more than a kind of philosophical gopher hole. And Newman wanted to show that Lessing's ditch really wasn't anything, that there really wasn't any problem. Lessing says, you can't get to eternal reason from the accidental truths of history. That didn't impress Newman. Newman recognized that any factual knowledge of the world is necessarily going to be based upon an investigation of historical and empirical considerations. You can't expect that to rise to 100% certainty, and any notion of reason that's 100% certain is entirely formal. But clearly, the problem here has to do with the weight of historical evidence. If historical evidence can't arrive at 100% certainty, then why does it serve as a suitable basis for religious knowledge? Answer, because of its probabilistic value, because of the plausibility of the evidence. If you're going to justify historical evidence or evidence from experience for establishing religious truth, you've inevitably got to do it in terms of the probabilistic value of the evidence. You can't do it on the basis of the absolute value of the evidence, since you never arrive at absolute certainty in collecting facts or analyzing them. We can see that in order to fill in Lessing's ditch, it's necessary for Newman to obtain some clods of probability. Newman is going to fill up Lessing's ditch with hunks of probability to prevent people from busting their noses by falling into it. Strictly speaking, people ought to be able to leap across Lessing's ditch without the slightest bit of difficulty, but since they have problems with this in a modern secular era, it becomes necessary to give them a little help. And that's exactly what Newman is doing. Now, he does this in two stages. Stage one, the essays on miracles. In stage one, Newman argues that there is a convergence of independent probabilities for the miracles of Christian faith. The magic expression here is convergence of independent probabilities. And this convergence points to the truth of the facts, so that the inquirer is justified in accepting them as true. A convergence of independent probabilities. The independent probabilities all point to the truth of the facts, and that gives a legitimate ground for the inquirer to accept these facts as true. The idea is that in arguing for a miraculous event, it isn't a matter of examining one single isolated fact which raises a certain probability. and then you accept the truth of the miracle on that basis. Instead, you are analyzing a gestalt. There's a pattern, a background, and among the considerations in this background, you will find a number of different factual considerations. You put all these factual considerations together, they converge, they point in the direction of the truth of the miracle. If you want to think of a practical example of this, think of the argument which has been used very effectively, that if you put witnesses on the stand, if it's, let's say, a negligence case, an accident case, and you are prosecuting in this case, and you want to show that the defendant is responsible for this accident. He is liable for this. You bring in witnesses, all right? Now, let's say you put on the stand four witnesses, and the witnesses say exactly the same thing. Every witness gets up on the stand and he says verbally the same thing. You are going to lose your case in spades, because that is the clearest evidence of collusion. But let us say that you put on the stand four different witnesses, and the witnesses state approximately the same thing, but there are superficial disagreements. And then on cross-examination and recross, it turns out that these are resolvable differences. They're due to the fact that these witnesses have looked at the same event from four different angles. Okay? That has a strong ring of truth to it, maybe even a prima facie truth value. There'd certainly be a presumption in favor of the truth of it that would have to be rebutted. Okay, there is a convergence of independent testimonies in a case like that. And you can see the immediate application of the gospel records. Now, it's true that the gospel writers use some common material. Luke says that he uses sources, and we can see the overlap. But it is also the case that those writings are of sufficient independence that they constitute a convergence of evidence in behalf of the truth of the miracles contained in them. It's that sort of thing that Newman is talking about. What he's trying to do here is to broaden the base of probability and indicate that it isn't just a matter of a single unified argument having a given probability, but instead it's a slew of arguments, and the arguments converge in pointing toward the truth. You could diagram this if you wanted to, if you think diagrammatically, as a circle, and you have arrows coming in from the circle toward the center. All around the circumference of the circle, you have arrows going in toward the center. These are the independent probabilities converging on the truth represented by the center of the circle. Now, Newman, of course, has in mind not just biblical miracles. He's referring here to he called revelational miracles, or simply church miracles. He defends not only the miracles in Scripture, but he defends certain other miracles that you might feel a little bit uncomfortable with, and that I certainly feel uncomfortable with. The sort of Fatima-type miracle, if you will. Yes. Now, if you think that the minute that you begin operating along this line, you're going to end up tromping around at Lourdes, then you will want to take a look at B.B. Warfield's book, Counterfeit Miracles. B.B. Warfield's book, Counterfeit Miracles. Warfield goes too far. Warfield, in order to deal with that kind of thing, argues that all miracles ceased once the canon of Scripture was completed. No miracle since then. It seems to me that you ought to be able to find your way in between these two positions somewhere. And the way to do this is by a strict empirical investigation of each individual miracle claim. If there's enough evidence for a miracle claim, then by gum, the miracle occurred, whether Old Testament, New Testament, or yesterday. At the same time, you don't want to conclude that just because the Lord loves a person who needs healing enough to heal him, that the Lord is necessarily putting an absolute stamp of approval on the person's theology. See, that's very important. Okay? See, the Lord might very well want to take care of a Christian Scientist goiter, wholly apart from the question of Christian Science. The Lord might conceivably weigh the lesser of the evils and conclude better that she should get rid of the goiter than that somebody might be influenced slightly in the direction of Christian Science. Maybe, I don't know. But the point I'm trying to make is that you can have a genuine healing miracle without it necessarily establishing the truth of the system within which it occurs. The truth of any theological proposition depends on one thing, its conformity to Scripture. If even an angel from heaven comes and preaches any other gospel from the one I have preached unto you, let him be anathema, says St. Paul. See, that's the test. So you got two independent questions here. Question one, did she have her goiter healed? Question number two, is her theology any good? And the two questions are not necessarily the same question. Of course, you realize from this that I would not put the case for Christianity on the basis only of healing miracles. Okay? The resurrection, which I consider to be the great miracle on which the case, miraculously speaking, depends, that is more than a healing miracle. It does something else, and we will be talking about that subsequently. I don't want to carry this too far, because I know how much you'd love to carry it in another direction. I would never get back to John Henry Newman, though if there's somebody who is just impassioned to justify being a two-seed in the Spirit predestinarian Baptist because of miracles, then I'll listen to that. There isn't? Fine. All right. We go on to the second stage in Newman's justification of the probability concept. And this is his greatest work on apologetics, The Grammar of Assent. Now, this is not a work of mystical theology. This is A-S-S-E-N-T, for corn's sake. It is not A-S-C-E-N-T. This is not St. John of the Cross clamoring up the mountain of mysticism or anything like that. This is John Henry Newman assenting to something. It's a Grammar of Assent. It's a marvelous title, really. And he wrote this in 1870. In my opinion, this is the great event in the year 1870 within Roman Catholicism. The Grammar of Assent is available inexpensively in English. It was written in English, so of course it's available in English. It is available in a Doubleday image paperback, Doubleday image books. That's the Roman Catholic series within the Doubleday image series. You can't get the First Vatican Council in paperback, so it's obvious that this is of more consequence, right? I mean, they've kept this in print, whereas they had a Second Vatican Council. Yes, all right. In The Grammar of Assent, Newman picks up from Bishop Butler, who was very much concerned in the 18th century with the probability concept. He picks up from Butler, and he argues that the process of assent is not only a convergent manifold of signs. This is really the sort of thing that he was talking about in the Essays on Miracles. the process of ascent is not just a matter of observing a convergence of signs, a manifold of independent probabilities pointing to a given result. But it goes to the principle that we would probably call reduction to the absurd. It goes to a reductio ad absurdum, namely, that an event is proven, after all. And we're quoting Newman directly here, an event is proven if its antecedents could not in reason be supposed to have happened otherwise, unless it were true. You can arrive at certainty, says Newman, if you have the following situation, that the antecedents of the event, the antecedents of the event, cannot in reason be supposed to have happened unless the event is true. Unquote. Now again, let me give you an illustration of this. And I've illustrated this a couple of periods ago in another connection when I talked about the standard of proof in criminal trials in the common law. The standard of proof that the accused is guilty only if you can demonstrate this beyond reasonable doubt. And beyond reasonable doubt is defined as eliminating all reasonable other explanations for the event except that the bird did it. Beyond reasonable doubt doesn't mean the elimination of all doubt. The only way you could eliminate all doubt, for goodness sake, would be to be God. Now, it's often said in the law, in the official methods of jury instruction, it's often stated that you could be perfectly certain of the situation if you were there yourself, if you as a jury man had actually been there and witnessed the crime. But then, of course, you couldn't be on the jury because then you'd be called as a witness. As a jury man in modern law, unlike the early common law, you couldn't have witnessed the event and also serve on the jury. In the early days, they brought in the witnesses as the jury, and that speeded up the trials immensely. but it left something to be desired, of course. You didn't get the impartiality of the present jury. But even if you were there and saw the event, you couldn't be absolutely certain, philosophically certain, metaphysically certain. Why? Because there could have been a mass hallucination, or there could have been an invisible Martian who actually did it instead of the accused. There are any number of metaphysical possibilities under those circumstances. The fact is that where factual events are concerned, you never can be absolutely certain. It's always a matter of probabilities. Okay, then, when can you say that the accused should get it? He should get it if you can exclude all reasonable other explanations, all other explanations that have something going for them other than the explanation that the accused did it. Okay, now, what Newman is saying in The Grammar of Assent is very much like this. He's saying that after you have taken this convergent manifold of signs, after you have taken the convergence of independent probabilities, you've, of course, increased the weight of the probabilities that way from a single line of argument. But you can go beyond that because you can take these and you can ask yourself the following question. Is there any other explanation of the given fact that you're trying to prove that has anything reasonable going for it? And if there isn't, then by process of elimination, you've got a right to affirm this even though your evidence is only probable. See, think of it this way. Think of it this way. Take the concrete example of the resurrection of Christ. How are you going to explain the resurrection of Christ? You've got four reasonable explanations of this, and by reasonable we mean in accord with the historical data, that fit the data. Four explanations that could conceivably fit the data. Okay? Number one, Jesus did in fact rise from the dead. There was a miraculous resurrection. Number two, the Jewish religious leaders stole the body. Because you've got to do something with the body. Next, the Romans stole the body. Finally, the disciples stole the body. Now, there are other explanations that you could give of the event. For example, Jesus was a Martian, so cleverly dressed in a Jesus suit that nobody could tell the difference. Or leprechauns did it, or so. I mean, there are other ways of explaining this, but these are not reasonable explanations, meaning that they are explanations that are entirely gratuitous, that you could also import for any other event, that don't have any necessary tie to the evidence for this event, that could be used just as well for you. You know, maybe the person sitting next to you is a Martian, so well-dressed in a student suit that you can't tell the difference. You see? And once you start that, boo, you'll end up in the booby hatch, or should end up in the booby hatch. All right, so you're left with these explanations. Now, you take these quote-unquote reasonable explanations, at least they're more reasonable than the ones that we just eliminated, and you begin looking at them, and you see whether these have anything going for them. And as you proceed, you find that explanations 2, 3, and 4 are not going to work. They are only apparently reasonable. They're only apparently reasonable because they do at least involve the actual data that the primary source witnesses have left us. Because after all, though the witnesses don't mention leprechauns and Martians, they do mention, after all, Romans and the Jews and disciples, you see? But that's about all these explanations do have going for them, because the Jewish religious leaders aren't going to take the body. If they take the body, then the rumor is going to get around that Jesus rose from the dead, and that's exactly what they want to prevent. They're the ones, in fact, who make sure that the Romans put a guard on the tomb to prevent such a rumor getting around. The Romans ain't going to do it because the Romans want to keep things quiet in Palestine. You don't keep things quiet by getting rumors going about people getting raised from the dead. And they're the ones who put the guard there. The disciples aren't going to do it because if the disciples do this, then they're going to go out and they're going to die for what they know to be untrue. And people don't do that. They die for a lot of screwball things that they think are true and aren't. But that's not the same thing as dying for something that you know to be false. So, these explanations fall away. And the case in behalf of the resurrection is not only supported by a convergence of independent testimonies, which raises the level of probability very, very high, but it's supported by a reductio ad absurdum that there isn't any other reasonable explanation. That is, any other explanation that fits the data. You see what Newman's doing. He's saying, yes, only probability. But look how much more impact there is to probability than you first thought. Probability's got a lot more going for it than you thought it did. That's what he's saying. Look at probability more closely, you will find that probability has a lot more in behalf of it than you thought when you first glanced at it. You thought it was only a grubby peasant, didn't you? And that such a peasant could not do philosophy. How can the accidental truths of history possibly rise to the level of the necessary truths of reason? Says Newman, they can't if you mean 100% certainty, but 100% certainty doesn't give you facts anyway, wouldn't do you any good. But this is sufficient to reach the level of conviction. It really is a far more aristocratic operation, a far more satisfactory operation than one that you thought originally. In the grammar of assent, Newman introduces a term which you must memorize. You are to tattoo this on your arm prior to the final examination so as to have it for ready reference. It is the term illative sense. Illative, I-double-L-ative. I-double-L-A-T-I-V-E, illative sense. Now, as every one of you knows from your high school Latin, that comes from the verb ferro, ferro, ferituli, latus, the last principal part of it. And illative means bring into or bring toward. This is in ferro, making iferro and finally illatus and so forth. Okay, it means bring to. The illative sense. The illative sense is Newman's term for the faculty of judging along the lines we have just given. It's the faculty of judging in terms of the facts, realizing that they create congeries of signs converging by way of independent probability toward a result, and that this result is of such a sort that alternative explanations are eliminated as irrational. Now, you don't want to have to go through that all the time, do you? And so Newman kindly gives you this expression. It's a code for Newman's approach to probability. Whenever you provide evidence that brings together independent probabilities to reach a particular conclusion, and secondly, you eliminate other explanations, leaving this as the only explanation that will handle the data, you are employing, utilizing the illative sense. You're acting illitatively, but he didn't employ the adverb. You're simply manifesting, expressing the illative sense. This faculty permits you to get from facts, even though they are not certain, to religious certainty. The illative sense is the faculty by which you can get from probability to certainty. Now, what do we have to say about all this? We say that this is hot stuff. We like it. We like it. If you'd like an example of a modern Roman Catholic argument along these lines, this kind of argumentation done by a modern Roman Catholic, you might want to read M.C., his first initials are M and then C, Darcy, D apostrophe A-R-C-Y. The title of the book is The Nature of Unbelief. I'm sorry, The Nature of Belief. The Nature of Belief by M.C. Darcy. Darcy is a better apologist than he is a systematic theologian. He's the one who wrote the book against Nigren's Agape and Eros. And if you were in my church history course last term, or even this term, you will have remembered that. There's a reference to Nigren's Agape and Eros in my book, The Shape of the Past. Darcy, unfortunately, wrote against that classic Lutheran treatment of the history of doctrine. But wholly apart from that, putting him only here in the apologetic realm, we find that this book is a good example of the use of the illative sense by a modern apologist. Okay, and if you'd like what I think is an even more striking example of this sort of thing, you want to get into contact with the late contemporary Anglican apologist Ian Ramsey, I-A-N, showing that he has some Scottish blood in him, and that's undoubtedly the reason for the strength of his apologetic. Ramsey, R-A-M-S-E-Y. He's not a flaccid, middle-of-the-road, mealy-mouthed, media-via Englishman, at least in his apologetic. The position taken by Ian Ramsey is an application of this probability concept directly to the apologetic task. And I'll give you a specific citation of this in Ian Ramsey. I've quoted the passage I'm going to give to you now in my essay on Tillich's philosophy of history that appears in Where is History Going? So if you'd like the quotation, you can get it there. It is quoted from Ian Ramsey's book, Christian Discourse. Christian Discourse, published by Oxford University Press in 1965. It's a marvelous book. Ian Ramsey has done some wonderful apologetics. He is the best contemporary apologist who uses the techniques of analytical philosophy. Listen to this passage. This is a corker, and we're going to conclude with it. Quote, Butler reminded us, good old Bishop Butler, you know, Butler reminded us that a total devotion to duty, shown, for example, by leaping into a river to save a drowning child, could and reasonably be associated with many empirical uncertainties and probabilities. We might be mistaken about the strength of the current, about our swimming ability, or whether in fact that floating heap was a child, and so on. But acknowledging these uncertainties, Butler claimed that we should nevertheless think a man in a literal sense distracted, not himself, who failed to respond to the moral challenge displayed by such a situation of great consequence. For Butler, this moral response reared on probabilities, this total devotion, and in Newman's phrase, this real assent, is reasonable, as being that which any reasonable man, anyone deserving to be called a person, would in similar consequences display. Probability in this special sense is the guide of life. So our Christian convictions, based upon historical uncertainties, are in principle reasonable as being one with the rest of life. Unquote. Now, what does he mean? He starts with Butler, he refines this by way of Newman, and he says, take this example. You're walking along and you see a fellow lying under a tree on a riverbank, and he is twiddling his thumbs, and he is twaddling his tongue, and he is not doing anything of much consequence. And out there in the river, there is what appears to be a drowning child, apparently calling for help. Now, it is impossible to demonstrate by the eternal truths of reason that it is a drowning child, or that it, whatever it is calling for help. You cannot demonstrate that 100%. There is no way to do that. You have only probabilities. Says Ramsey, we would consider such a person literally deranged who did not respond to the moral challenge of that situation. There is a moral response demanded by that situation. Why? Because there are congeries of independent probabilities. You see the kid out there, he's talking, you know, you hear him, these various independent items of evidence come to play upon you. They point in a single direction. The single direction is that it is a drowning child out there, and you can quickly eliminate alternative explanations, the bizarre ones that it's actually a Martian disguised as a drowning child, you know, and that the child is out there training for a movie role, and so forth and so forth. These disappear by reduction to absurdity, and so you are morally compelled on the basis of probability to get into that water and out there to save the child. If you don't do this, you are regarded as morally at fault for not doing it. Says Ian Ramsey, all we're doing as Christians is presenting evidence like that, and such evidence demands a moral response. You can't just sit by the side of the river of life and allow events to go on without your morally responding to them. You can't sit there at the foot of the cross and watch Jesus die there for you and excuse yourself from responding to that because the evidence is only probable. And on that note, we conclude. Next time, we are in the 20th century. We'll be talking about Edward John Carnell. We'll be talking about C.S. Lewis and other contemporaries. And we'll be moving rapidly to what I hope to be some interesting new insights in the apologetic realm.